operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee is the third Thursday of each month at 5 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
We were homeward bound the night on the deep. Swinging in my hammock, I fell asleep. I dreamed a dream and I thought it true. Concern Franklin and his gallant crew.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KABU program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Paul Watson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. In conversation with Lawrence Howard, co-founder of Portland Story Theater and the writer-performer for their Armchair Adventurers series. In Ice Ghosts, Paul Watson tells the story of the Lost Franklin Expedition of 1845 and the crew of the HMS Erebus and Terror, setting off in search of the fabled Northwest Passage. Both ships and the entire crew of 129 were lost in the Arctic ice. It wasn't until 2014 that the wreck of the HMS Erebus was discovered, and Paul himself was on the icebreaker that led the quest. He also broke the news of the discovery of the wreck of its sister ship, the HMS Terror, in 2016. Lawrence Howard, along with his wife Lynn Duddy, founded Portland Story Theater. In his role of writer and performer, Lawrence has created Portland Story Theater's Armchair Adventurers series, recounting tales of famous Antarctic and Arctic explorers, including Ernest Shackleton, Roald Amundsen, Robert Scott, Douglas Mawson, and Fridtjof Nansen. Let's join Paul and Lawrence as they talk about Paul's new book, The Franklin Expedition, and the amazing story of how the doomed ships were discovered over 160 years later.
Hello, Paul.
Hi, Lawrence.
Great. Good morning. It's wonderful to finally meet you.
I'm
glad to be here at KABU having this conversation. Your book is Ice Ghosts, about the hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition, and it's just great to be here with you and talk about that.
Same here. I'm really looking forward to it.
When Ken first asked me to do this, I was a little hesitant because although I'm a polar enthusiast, I'm more of an Antarctic guy than an Arctic guy. But Ken assured me that this would be a fun conversation for us to have. And as I read your book and really learned more about Franklin, I realized that I did know quite a bit about the Arctic and that there's actually quite a bit of crossover between the Arctic expeditions and the Antarctic expeditions that I'm more familiar with.
Right. And as I researched it, because, you know, being a good Canadian boy, I knew bits of the Franklin story, but not a lot about it.
Right.
And actually, you know, I should admit, as a good Canadian boy, I didn't think it was all that interesting because it's history and
right.
lost ships and that sort of
yeah.
thing.
And also long ago.
That's right.
Yeah.
But once you start to dig down into the details, it really seeps into your blood, and it did in mine. And one of the things that I realized is that in that era, they referred to them as polar explorers.
Right.
So it's the Brotherhood of Polar Explorers. Right. They were interested in both poles.
One of the first things that strikes me about this, when I started reading, I had never understood the names of the two ships, the Erebus and the Terror, until I read in your book that before they were polar vessels, they were bomb vessels and, in fact, had been part of the War of 1812 and had been part of that Battle of Fort McHenry that the Star-Spangled Banner is written about. And then it made sense, Erebus, this, you know, Greek god of the underworld, I think.
Right. I've seen different explanations for the name. One is that. Another is the name for the gateway to hell.
Right.
But the point being, it's hellish.
These were names calculated to strike fear and terror into the hearts of the enemy, of the
That's
adversary.
That's right. That's right. And when the archaeologists finally got down on these wrecks, the marine archaeologists, these are divers who are also scientists, and they sort of reach for words to describe the immensity of these vessels,
yeah,
even underwater, you can imagine they sure did strike terror. you know, when they're firing those bombs from the mortars, it must have been terrifying.
Yes. Yes, it must have been. Ice ghosts. Wow, the whole story is filled with these kind of ghostly episodes and feelings and stories. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I also want to admit this, that when I set out to write the book, I had a sense. I had a title, but I didn't have the information to go with the title.
Mm-hmm.
I had an instinct and an interest in the spirit world, I would call it, which began with life experience in war. And I think anyone who has seen as much war as I have would tell you the same thing. When I came at this story, I had an inkling that there would be an important connection to the spirit world, both through the Inuit, who have lived longest in the Arctic.
Right.
And I had that sense because I had been alone, on walking outside of small hamlets in the high Arctic in winter,
mm-hmm,
when there's not a whiff of breeze.
Right.
And you're cold but warm because you're wearing furs and other things.
Right.
But you can feel the intensity of the cold in your nostrils, your teeth hurt when you take a breath, that sort of thing. And you are truly alone with the world in a situation like that. And I immediately got a sense of things that I couldn't see or understand,
mm-hmm,
but were real. And so I set off on that exploration of sorts to find out, is there a story that matches the title Ice Ghost?
Right,
now, I would have been
right,
in a
right.
mess of trouble if I hadn't found the story because I had a book deal. But I found much more than I'd ever expected.
Mm-hmm.
It's both in the Inuit stories and in the stories of the Victorian period when, for instance, Lady Jane Franklin, the
yes.
widow of Sir John, the commander of the expedition,
mm-hmm,
who was an extraordinarily smart and adventurous woman who had traveled on her own in some of the most difficult places in the
right,
world, in the
right.
Middle East and such. She was so desperate to get any bit of information she could find that she also tried to contact the spirit world
right.
to see if she could get answers there.
Right.
So it ended up being a very rich ghost story.
Right, and through that attempt with mediums and seances and so on, she did receive some information about where she thought they ought to look for her husband, didn't she?
That's right, and she acted on it.
Yeah,
she wrote a lot of letters and kept very detailed journals,
mm-hmm,
and there are written references to people in the Admiralty, for instance, which was the bureaucracy that oversaw the Royal Navy, which was the
right.
most powerful navy on earth
right.
in its time. There are references to suggestions she had made in terms of refining the search area.
Right.
Based on information she got not from so-called polar experts, but from the spirit world.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a religious person,
mm-hmm,
but I would say I'm a spiritual person.
Uh-huh.
I don't attend seances or do that sort of thing.
Right,
I don't try to talk to dead relatives with a Ouija board.
Mm-hmm.
But I am open to the possibility that there are things we cannot see, that we don't understand, that are very real.
Right.
When HMS Erebus, Sir John Franklin's flagship, the ship on which he lived and worked,
mm-hmm,
in this effort to find the Northwest Passage, when her wreck was discovered in 2014, it was exciting. This is a nice story to report as a journalist.
Yes.
Because I was the only one there.
Right.
But it's not the sort of thing you'd write a book about. Until I heard how she was found.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, this is one of those coincidences that probably is speaking to, you know, the part of me that believes in synchronicity and those sorts of mysterious.
Sure. Do you want to tell us that story about how she was found and what that connection is? Is this the story where the Inuit man thought he saw the mast of the ship?
That's even better.
But
that comes later. But
okay.
that's another.
That's in relation to the terror, right?
Sure. I'll gladly tell you that one because it's even better.
Okay, great.
The first one is this. People tend to think that the discovery of the first ship was a technology story.
Right.
Even now.
Sonar.
That's right. Yeah. People will say, well, you know, what technology led to the breakthrough?
Right, right.
And I like to tell them, you know, there's sonar, but that's 1960s, 70s sort of technology. It's not a big deal.
Right.
If you go fishing, you use sonar.
Yes.
The wreck of the Erebus was in relatively shallow water.
Right.
I have stood above it on ice, thick winter ice, with a hole blasted in it so that divers could
yes,
go down
yes.
to the wreck. And I can tell you, you can see the...
You can look down and see
the deck right there. It's that...
It's in like 70, 80 feet of water, is that correct?
Right, but the top part of the ship, you know, I'll have to check it, but it's a matter of some feet. It's not very far down.
Okay.
If you jumped in the water, you would hit it.
I see.
That's the top of the ship, right?
It's tall, the mast, yeah, projects up quite a bit.
Right, the masts themselves are gone. The ice has sheared those off.
Oh, I see, okay.
But the actual outer deck, top deck of the vessel mm-hmm. is right there.
Okay.
And, of course, it's a warship. It's a bomb ship, so it's quite a big, sturdy vessel.
Right.
But it's sitting on the bottom, so the... If you go from the seabed to the top of the upper deck,
mm-hmm.
it's almost on the surface of the water.
Okay.
And in fact, people tell me when storms whip up, as they always do in the fall, heavy gales, a witness to this told me that part of the ship was exposed as heavy rollers went through.
Uh-huh.
So that gives you another indication of how shallow.
Right.
So that's all to say that the ship was really not that hard to find.
Yes.
Except
if you knew where to look.
That's right. And the Inuit had told people where to look since almost the beginning.
Right.
When 19th century searchers went looking.
Yes.
The trouble was a couple of things. In that era, and this is true to some extent even today, in that era, the Inuit were treated as so-called savages.
Right. Primitive people.
That's right. Primitive people.
Right.
They're mystics. They make things up. They're even outright liars.
Mm-hmm.
You can't trust them.
Right.
So it was largely dismissed. And the flip side of that is that we're people of science, and we're the British, and we have the British Empire.
Right.
And we say the ships are up here, because that's where Sir John was told to go.
His orders from the Admiralty. Right.
Right. They were to sail north, and why? Because the great white man's science said if you sail north, you'll come to a paradise.
The open polar sea.
That's right.
They believed in it
those
days. Right.
A temperate sea at the top of the world that will be almost a tropical paradise.
Right.
And you'll be able to sail over the top.
Right.
We were the smart ones. The Inuit were the dumb savages. Mm-hmm. And so the searches were concentrated much further north.
Yes.
Now, come the late summer of 2014... This is also sort of, you know, the circumstances start to add up, the odd sort of events. For several years before 2014,
mm-hmm.
each time they went up to do this search, the ice, due to climate change, had been receding.
Yes.
So they didn't have a lot of trouble in that area further north where the ships had been abandoned.
Right.
Looking in that area.
Right.
Suddenly in 2014, the ice is back. So it makes it too dangerous to search in that northern area. So the search is forced to concentrate in the southern area where the Inuit stories all along had said there was a ship.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, our guest is Paul Watson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition, in conversation with Lawrence Howard, co-founder of Portland Story Theater and writer-performer for their Armchair Adventurers series.
One day, a helicopter pilot named Andrew Stirling. He was born in Scotland. His father and grandfather both have a connection to the British military. One mm-hmm. was a soldier in the trenches in World War I. A dum-dum bullet badly damaged his hand, so the only work he could get was polishing furniture. It's called French polish.
Yes, I'm familiar with it. I used to be a cabinet maker.
Well, you see? So you'd know that French polishing isn't just taking a bunch of wax and just buffing it up.
No. It's a very complicated process with shellac and linseed oil.
Right, and takes great talent.
Yes.
And so if you're capable of doing that, you could end up working for the royal family.
Wow.
Well, sure enough, Andrew Stirling's grandfather was a French polisher in Balmoral Castle, which is the royal family's castle in
Scotland, yes.
Right? And then his father was a sailor in the Royal Navy, mm-hmm. the very Royal Navy that sent Sir John Franklin and his men to their deaths in the Canadian High Arctic.
Right.
So you could say, well, so what? That's a coincidence mm-hmm. because it is Andrew Stirling who's walking along the shore one day
right.
of a remote island in the eastern Queen Maud Gulf, which is just above the coast of the North American continent, the
right.
Arctic coast.
Uh-huh.
He had a shotgun with him because after landing his helicopter, the passengers, who were two land-based archaeologists and a hydrographer, this is a federal worker who works with a team that are charting the seabed.
Okay.
So as these guys are doing their work on this remote island, Andrew Stirling, descendant of, a grandfather and father with connection to the royal family mm-hmm. and the Royal Navy, is looking for polar bears
right.
because polar bears like to eat humans. So you got to be careful.
Polar bears are very hungry nowadays.
That's right.
Yes, yeah.
That's right. And he has a hobby interest in archaeology because he inherited this from his father.
Mm-hmm.
And since he has spent so much time ferrying around professional archaeologists, he's learned how to look for objects on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So his eyes are peeled as he walks. He comes across an object which I'm pretty sure you or I or any other person who didn't have his experience probably wouldn't have seen.
Wouldn't really recognize? Or
it's a piece of rusting iron.
Uh-huh.
It's roughly the shape of a hairpin, and it's roughly the length of a man's forearm.
Okay.
And it was flush against a rock,
uh-huh.
And it's covered in lichen. The rocks are covered in lichen,
right,
and so they're
right.
similar colors. It kind
yes.
of blends in.
And you could have easily missed it.
Easily walked past it.
Uh-huh.
But he spotted it and called over the experts because they told him, if you ever see something,
don't touch it.
Right. So the experts come over, and the most senior archaeologist picks it up. And at first he thought, not likely from a Franklin vessel because it doesn't have the telltale broad arrow. Now, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much stealing from Royal Navy vessels in the Victorian era.
Really?
That even objects as small as a nail
yes.
would have a broad arrow on it.
Would be stamped with some kind of an identifying symbol.
That's right. Always the broad arrow.
A broad arrow.
So if the police went looking for thieves and they found a nail with a broad arrow on it, they say, oi, how'd you get this, mate?
Stolen from the Navy.
That's
yeah.
right. Come with us. in this case, he thought he didn't see the broad arrow. But
right.
as he turned it over and moved his hand, sure enough, his hand had been covering
there
the broad arrow.
On the back side.
So there it is. That could have got there any number of ways. The
right.
Inuit had a very strong need for wood
yes.
and metals because there's no trees up there.
Right, right.
And they couldn't forge metals themselves.
Right.
So if they ever found things like that, which either fell off ships or were pieces of wrecks that
washed up,
that
yeah.
washed up if
yeah.
they ever found them.
They would use them.
That's right.
They would repurpose them.
They're treasured.
Right.
So it's possible that someone could have found that This object is called a davit, a piece of a davit.
Sure.
And any boat owners listening will have davits today.
Right, right.
On a boat which has a smaller boat, like a tender.
A lifeboat of some kind, right.
Uses a davit system to raise and lower the smaller craft in and out of the water.
Right, brackets that hang the lifeboat on the side of the larger boat.
That's right. Exactly right. So that's what this was. The davit piece and also two pieces of wood, which together form a wooden plug for a hole on the deck, where the experts tell me this would have been called a hawse hole, which is where the hawser,
the heavy cable.
That's right. That's exactly right. They called them cables in those days, but it's heavy rope.
Right, right.
Where that would have run through a hole probably to an anchor.
To an anchor, right.
Or to be tied to a dock or something.
Sure, sure.
That when you coil up the rope, you no longer need the hole. You plug it so that the sea doesn't pour into it, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, he found the two halves of one of those. So together, those objects very strongly suggest that there's a Franklin ship somewhere in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Sure enough, they took the objects back. They had a meeting, quite excited, with the underwater archaeologists. And they made a plan for the next morning and immediately went out early in the morning. And their technique is to do what they call mowing the lawn. It's a vessel that has they call it a towfish, but it's a sonar device, which is like a light torpedo. It's torpedo shaped.
Okay.
You can lift it.
Yeah.
They put it in the water. It's connected with a steel cable. It produces a sort of a fuzzy image on a laptop computer.
Mm-hmm.
They go up one lane, do a turn, which is the mowing the lawn,
right,
come back.
Right.
They were coming back on the second
lane.
So
they're covering all the area, the surface.
That's right, in parallel lines.
Yes.
Suddenly, something came on the screen, a large object on the seabed, and the archaeologist shouted to the group, "That's it." And sure enough, that was a Franklin ship, which turned out to be HMS Erebus, John's flagship.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's a long story to tell you that as soon as I heard it and heard that Andrew Sterling, a guy with a Royal Navy past in the family and a Royal Family connection through a furniture polisher, found this item, the storyteller in me says, hold on a second. If I were writing a script for a Hollywood movie, sure, I'd make that guy find it.
Right, right, right.
Not the people with all the sonar and everything
else.
The experts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was intrigued, and I thought, it doesn't sound like a coincidence to me because I'm open to these things.
Right.
So I pitched a book idea without having any idea whether there was anything else that would support a title, Ice Ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
But again, having an inkling. There are a lot of people who read the story will find out inklings have a lot to do with success in looking for Arctic shipwrecks and also writing about them.
Wow.
There are a lot of mysterious connections between people past and present and other things, which make you think, as one of the marine archaeologists said to me, a few days after the vessel was discovered, literally with tears in his eyes, he said, it's almost as if this ship wanted to be found.
Wanted to be found. Wow.
Which also, by the way, got me interested. It sends a shiver up my spine as I say it.
Right.
And I think he was right, but then the question is, well, why would it want to be found in 2014?
And why now, right?
That's
They've
right.
been searching for these ships for 160 years, is it?
So right.
1845 is when
Right,
they
or a little
right?
bit after that because,
yeah.
you know, like...
Right, 1845 is when they departed.
Right. So the actual search, the full-scale search is 1848 and on.
Right.
But people were making a sort of minor attempts just a little before that.
Mm-hmm.
You get the sense of the duration. So the question is, why now? I answer that in two ways. Again, when you read Ice Ghosts, you know that if these ships wanted to be found, even if the sailors themselves, when they were alive, wanted to be found, there were messages going out in strange ways.
Right.
people were getting information either through instinct or through spiritual contact, apparently, if you want to believe those things,
right,
way back in the Victorian era.
Right.
The problem is people weren't listening. This is an important part to the end of Ice Ghosts. I don't say this. The Inuit say it and others, that the Arctic is trying to speak to us even today. It's warming fast, twice as fast as anywhere else on the planet.
Right.
In some specific parts of the Arctic, it's warming even faster than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe this to my core, that although most of us will never go to the Arctic, most of us, meaning most of the people on this planet, most of the people on this planet will never even think of the Arctic.
Right.
But it is in a very real sense our destiny, because it acts like a kind of air conditioner for
right,
the world.
Right, right.
The white snow and ice reflects a large amount of heat.
Right.
The very fact that it's cold and that air currents bring some of that cooling air south
right.
moderates the heat as the planet warms
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and other factors. It is essential to the Earth being a habitable place for large numbers of people.
Right.
And scientists tell us, and the evidence is very clear even now, that air conditioner, if I can use that crass term,
sure.
is at risk. Three times this year, at least, the temperatures at the North Pole have been close to freezing. They've almost gone above freezing.
Wow.
In the middle of the winter. That's
up
an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
You know, up to 50 degrees higher.
Wow.
50 degrees warmer than normal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The ice cover up there has set a new record low this year.
Right.
Also, you know, the air of your specialty.
Yes,
in the Antarctic
as well.
These are alarming signals of what's happening to our planet.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of, well, if those ships wanted to be found, why now? The answer I give to that question is because things are going on up there that we need to start listening to.
Right.
And if the adventure that surrounds the effort to find these ships gets ordinary people to start paying to the Arctic, that could be a good thing because they'll
right.
start listening to what it's trying to tell us.
Drawing attention to the Arctic.
Before it's too late.
Right, right. Fascinating. Wow, I could sit here and talk to you for several more hours, Paul.
Same
but
here.
I think
Same
our
here.
Our time is up. It's just been really, really wonderful to talk to you about all this stuff. I have so many more questions, but wow, your knowledge, not only of the actual stuff, but all the tangential stuff that is connected to it is very deep and super interesting to me. This has just been a real pleasure to talk to you about this.
I feel like I could be a sailor with a fellow sailor and a cup of grog, and we could go late into the night.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Paul Watson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition, in conversation with Lawrence Howard, co-founder of Portland Story Theater and writer-performer for their Armchair Adventurers series. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Paul and Lawrence for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
Now my burden, it gives me pain. I find Lord Franklin, I cross the main. 10,000 pounds I would freely give to know on earth if Franklin lives.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PugsFest, Saturday, April 22nd at Tabor Space in Portland. PugsFest is a celebration of lifelong learning with a whole day dedicated to sharing ideas and questions through original workshops. This year, our central theme is space and spaces. Spaces in between, spaces outside, spaces of resistance. Workshops include Truth in the Social, The Echo Chamber and Wild Spaces,